Monsieur Ramier.
Hi, good afternoon or morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I think this is a great pleasure for me to be here. And I'm really sorry I am not able to be part for a longer period with all of you. Just to start, Rania asked me to introduce myself a little bit. I'm currently working with UNIFEM based here in New York, responsible for the gender responsive budgeting work that UNIFEM had started actually since 2000 and has continued to work on it systematically, as this is viewed by UNIFEM and many as a very strategic and important area of work that, if we're talking about implementation of women's rights, that we have to be looking at the economic dimensions and definitely on the financing and the adequacy of the economic policies. And this has been a continuous effort, both because for us, looking at what how gender equality advocates have been looking at women's rights over a long history, we felt that there is a need to incorporate the understanding of economic policy and budgets into that kind of advocacy and the work towards women's rights. But also, on the other hand, that economists need to understand where the gaps are in the traditional approaches and classical economic theory that sort of invisibilizes women and considers them to be neutral in many respects, and we know that the realities are not. And this is where the this work has been challenging, because it's sort of changing a mindset, both for the economic discourse and ministries of finance, but also for women's groups and gender equality advocates. And I think we have been trying to build more proximity between the discourse on women's rights and the demands for the implementation of commitments towards women's rights with economic policies that actually put women as part of the formula and as part of the models and as part of the intended outcomes and key contributors to economic growth and employment and so on. I come, before coming to New York, I come from the Arab region. I'm originally Palestinian, who have never lived in Palestine. And I was in the Arab region working for many years. Started as social researcher at the field level and moved towards working on development. And there was a part that I was in the banking sector and I quickly ran away. And since working with UNIFEM, I've done a lot of work beyond the Arab region in Africa and Asia and in Latin America, but mainly based in New York and mainly supporting the work on gender-responsive budgeting. And over the years that I've been there, which are now 8 years, I've been really accompanying the evolution of the work on gender-responsive budgeting from its very beginnings to where we are today, from looking at just basic awareness on what that means and what are the implications of our work, to understanding what the fiscal space means, what looking at taxation policy means, what aid effectiveness agendas and the whole discussion on financing for development means. So throughout those years, my interests have been in really exploring more in depth the way we are doing this work and trying to support its interpretation and application at country level. And of course, on a conceptual level, one of the things that we have done working with Diane Elson was looking at the budgets as a way to monitor accountability of governments towards the implementation of the Convention of Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. This is like a mouthful, but basically this is the Human Rights Convention that, that seeks to address discrimination against women in across sectors. And for so many years, the governments who have ratified this agreement have reported back on the progress that they have been achieving by listing the laws they have introduced and the policies they have adopted, and never really looking at how much money they have invested in implementing these laws or these policies. And the work that we had done in UNIFEM with Diane was really to bring out that the compliance with the implementation of CEDAW has to also extend to budgets as well as economic policies. So this is, in a nutshell, I think, a small introduction to myself and the work that I've been involved in for the past few years. Just to start, I think it's important to say that the presentation that started this morning with Dimitris laying out the overall fiscal and monetary aspects of what constitutes elements of the budgets and what constitutes the tensions between the role of government and whether we're talking about big government or big reserves and so on is very relevant to the discussion on gender responsive budgeting. And what we are going to be talking about is to start with just the basic what makes up a budget and what does gender-responsive budgeting actually mean, what are the key principles and purpose of it, and then introduce very quickly the gender budget analysis tools, at least some of them, and then look at the experiences from around the world in translating a lot of these concepts and these principles into actual work influencing government budgets and government plans and the way spending as well as taxation takes place. And just sharing with you some of the experiences and lessons learned from the work that UNIFEM has been supporting, which spans actually more than 30 countries around the world, some who have been consistently moving forward and some which have done small experiences, sometimes successfully and sometimes without success. So I'll be sharing that with you, but also the information that I'm going to be sharing also looks beyond the work that UNIFEM has been supporting, while noting that really the majority of the support towards gender-responsive budgeting has been from UNIFEM's side, and not to say that, you know, UNIFEM is doing so great, but to say that there has really not been a serious support to the work on gender-responsive budgeting beyond the main UN agency that is dealing with women's rights. And in a way that this is unfortunate because there are many actors who are maybe in a better position to influence budget reform and economic policies, and there is still resistance for that uptake to be happening. So what makes a budget? I think to just as an umbrella statement to say the budget is an instrument for translating fiscal policy by government. And we know that economic management is represented by the fiscal policy that involves government use of resources, its spending and taxation and borrowing to influence both the pattern of economic activity and the level of aggregate demand and output and employment. And on the other hand, there is the monetary policy that deals with interest rates and controls levels of growth and aggregate demand in the economy. So in this respect, the budget is a key element of the fiscal policy, and it consists in very generic terms of both sides, and in many ways we need to emphasize that, because when we're talking about spending and budgets towards supporting gender equality, we are talking about both sides of the budget. Whether it is on taxation policies, trade revenues, ODA, that in many countries that we're talking about is a key element of the budget, and in some countries goes as high as 60% of the budget that is used for spending. And we know that the overseas development assistance is taking different forms and shapes. Some of them include direct budget support, so it's money going into the directly to the budget of the government, or deficit stabilizers, or sectoral programs and direct budget support towards sectoral budgets, and support to non-governmental organizations. And of course, borrowing at home and abroad, asset sales, and printing money. On the expenses side, we know where government money goes towards government administration, provision of public services and investments, and transfer payments and benefits, and defense, and somebody was talking about that a little bit earlier, and debt repayment, and especially, again, in the context of many developing countries, debt repayment constitutes a big portion of the budget. So governments would withdraw the resources from society in the forms of taxation and contribute resources back to society in the form of expenditures. But are the burdens of taxation and benefits of government expenditures distributed equally? And this is really a question of equity and whether in the benefit incidence or in the impact. And this is where the gender dimension becomes very important, because for many gender equality advocates, we can see that today we are still faced with a reality that whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about health, whether we're talking about employment, poverty, the gender gaps remain huge. And even gaps amongst women's groups, if we're talking about indigenous women in some countries, or women of a certain caste in another, the inequalities are vast, and the government spending in many respects is blind towards these inequalities, and assumes that there is a neutrality in when we are putting a value-added tax policy across the board. It's neutral. It affects everybody in the same way. But because the realities are different for different groups of the population, this is not sufficient. And there needs to be other measures to be in place to make sure that whether we're talking about spending or about taxation, there is a concern with equity, and there are certain measures that are introduced to address those inequalities. So, again, of course, gender-responsive budgeting applies to all countries, but the main focus that we have been looking at is looking at countries in developing countries where there are serious challenges in human development and economic development and women's rights. So the realities in the developing countries are the small revenue base, the heavy debt burdens, the unfavorable trade systems, fragile governments, and inadequate ODA. There are fiscal policies with technical deficiencies, like we heard this morning about the case of South Africa. There are inexplicable measures that and policies that are usually in place. There are fiscal policies that take a political nature and represent the interests and voice of particular groups of people. And there is, like I said earlier, a general invisibility of the role of women in the economy. Whether women are in the informal sector, that is not counted. Whether women are doing unpaid work in agriculture, that is invisible in the economic records. Whether the government cuts budgets on health and decide that we have to make sure that the days spent in a hospital do not exceed 2 days, even if the patient still requires care, they should be sent home. What does that mean for women? These are elements that have implications for women's unpaid work and generally the reproductive role that they provide. And as we know, there's only 24 hours per day. So if you increase your work and care work every day from 5 hours to 10, that means you have less time to spend in gainful employment and in income generation activities, and therefore your access to income and access to resources is not working well in your favor. Of course, also the questions of the realities of women with regard to the access to assets and access to lands, violence against women, which is in many cases is gender-based, and intra-household biases, where we know that within the household, girls have different kinds of access to the share of the income. The women have a different part of the budget of the household and access to it. So these are, in broad terms, a lot of the questions that are raised by feminist economists and women's rights advocates, identifying where the realities of women are different from the realities of men, and therefore the budget policies and budget spending and taxation policies have to take those differences into consideration. So, what is gender-responsive budgeting? Gender-responsive budgeting is talking about engaging with the budget as the key, most important policy tool of government. And maybe it's not the most important, but it's one of the definitely important policy tools of government. Because that is how the government policies are executed and implemented. The gender responsiveness of the budget means that this policy instrument actually takes into consideration the needs and interests of individuals from different social groups. And I have to highlight that when we're talking about gender-responsive budgeting, we're not just making the distinction between men and women or boys and girls. We are also talking about looking at different groups of women across the board, because we know not all women have the same kind of needs, and not all men have the same kind of needs. And we have to keep in mind the age, the race, the ethnicity. And one of the first experiences of gender-responsive budgeting has actually started in South Africa in the post-apartheid government, where there were definitely an issue, many issues of inequalities with regard to women's rights, but also the issue of race was a key element of the justice element of the work on gender-responsive budgeting. They are not separate budgets from the main budget, and I think this is quite important because there has been many misconceptions that let's talk about a budget for women and let's see what women need, and some people think women need sewing machines, and others they think they need childcare services and so on. And this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at the whole budget and making sure that all the budget decisions are actually taking are based on a gender analysis that identifies where the gaps are and where the needed investments are. And in other ways, also part of the misconceptions was in some sense saying, okay, we're talking about equality, so let's split. If we're talking about the budget of the health ministry, let's say 50% of the budget should go to women and 50% to men. And also that's, of course, a misconception. And there are many different interpretations then to what we can do with the budgeting and integrating a gender perspective. But there are two key principles that I would like to highlight. The first one is the acknowledgement and recognition of the ways in which women contribute to the economy with their unpaid work and in the productive sector and in the reproductive work. And the acknowledgement that this role that women have and this unpaid work that they carry out has implications and is impacted by budget policies. And any budget decision needs to be taking this into account. And I'm sharing this from a colleague of mine, Yassine actually, who had done this, just showing that there is the whole range of social work that is performed in a society. Part of it is provided by government, and part of it is provided by individuals, and in many respects, women. So when there are budget cuts in schooling, in school budgets, in health care or in child care, what happens is this space that is to be provided by individuals expands or shrinks, and this in many respects has implications for women, and women are expected to be subsidizing this kind of gap. And of course now in the context of the economic crisis, these kinds of budget cuts are expected more and more and are happening more and more. And this is definitely one of the ways that the current economic situation is impacting women in a negative way. The other principle is the need to ensure that gender-responsive budgeting addresses discrimination and exclusion and looks at the groups that are most impacted or most excluded. That the priorities of poor women need to be reflected, that the voices of women are included in the budget policy making. And if we're talking about a rights-based approach to development, this needs to be a purpose and a main principle of the work, that we are really gearing our work towards addressing poverty, discrimination, and inequalities, but also opening the space for participation and their contribution towards formulating what are the priorities. And in a sense, when we're talking about budgeting that takes into consideration women's realities and is based on analysis of what are the priorities and channels, resources, and money that is not necessarily in abundance, especially in poorer countries, we're talking about accountability and the accountability of governments to implement commitments towards gender equality, because there is no country in the world that tells you, listen, we're not prioritizing, we don't think women are important, and we refuse to sign the conventions and on women's rights. In many countries, they have ratified the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination. They have national laws, but we need to really look at what does that mean in terms of accountability. It talks about more transparency in economic policies, and when we're talking about having access to budget information and how decisions about budget priorities are made. This also aligns with many concerns about corruption and the transparency of government. And more importantly, I think, and something that everybody agrees on, is looking at the effectiveness and efficiency of the use of public resources. And whether we're talking from an economic efficiency side or from an effectiveness demand of citizens, where we do not want to see our money squandered, we do not want to see the taxes that we pay or the contributions that are made to the economy simply wasted or benefiting the wrong groups of the population. So looking back, basically, I'm just giving you the political vision behind the work on gender responsive budgeting. In practice, what does it mean? In many respects, the work on gender budgeting has actually started with the introduction of budget analysis tools. And these, many of you are familiar with them because they are also economic tools for whether we're talking about benefit incidence analysis or social research analysis, that says, let's look at the budget and where the money is allocated and how it is being spent, or let's look at taxation. And I hear you've already had the sessions on doing the taxation analysis with a gender perspective. So the fact of the matter is there are many tools. Some of them are what we're called the gender budget analysis tools, but also there are many more ways to be doing this kind of analysis and applying different economic analysis tools as well as social research tools. But because we are talking about human beings and economic policies and money matters, we are really talking about linking the analysis of where the human development requirements are, where the inequalities exist, and making the link with the economic policies and the budget allocations. And this carries out a very simple process that is, as you all know, is the planning and budgeting process within any government. Within any government machine, this is how the work of the government happens. Every year there is the process of the Ministry of Finance issuing a call circular saying this is how much money we have, these are the priorities that we have. In the meantime, there is the national development plans that are in place that say these are the priorities that we have. We want economic growth. We want health for our citizens. We want to build bridges or whatever it is. So how can we really make sure that the plans are based on what the realities are and that the money is going towards where the priorities that our plans have identified? And so if we're looking at that process of planning and budgeting, from a gender perspective, it has to follow these five steps. The first, the beginning of situational analysis and looking at the policies that are in place, looking at the budgets that are allocated, making sure that after the money is allocated in the budget, how it is spent, because many times there is evaporation that happens or diversion that takes place. There are many assessment tools to look at the impact of spending, because as we know, sometimes you spend, for example, I was just reading recently an article on spending on maternal mortality, where civil society groups have done an analysis of government spending on maternal mortality. The spending has increased, whereas the maternal mortality rates have not dropped. And the reason for that was that the money was not being spent on the elements that are needed to address maternal mortality. For example, that when women are dying, it's because of lack of emergency services and blood rather than clinics. And if you're spending your money on clinics, but you're not making sure that those clinics have blood, then the woman will still be dying. So it's also looking at how the budget, how the allocations are spent, and spent in a way that is based on an understanding of where the gaps are. And just as I said, this is, in a way, it's a basic process that we all know. It, whatever you're doing, it entails planning and budgeting. But the question is, how do you make sure that at each of these steps, you are really intentionally making sure that you are including a gender perspective? And as I mentioned, there have been the what are typically known as the gender budget analysis tools, but my observation is that these have not been extensively applied in the experiences of gender budgeting that I have been seeing. Just to share with you very quickly, some kind of mapping of the experiences of gender-responsive budgeting that I have seen, and then later after lunch, I think Lucia will be sharing with you the experience from Mexico in much more detail. But just to say, there are so many different experiences and so many different approaches that have tried different entry points, and because countries have different realities, different capacities, and different political context and economic context, we cannot be saying this is the model, this is how India has done it, so everybody needs to follow that pattern, or this is how Mexico has done it. I think it's very important to understand that there is quite a diversity in the kinds of entry points, the kinds of approaches, and understanding that this work is combined two key elements. On the one hand, it's a technical element that you have to understand, the nitty-gritties of the budgeting work and the macroeconomic and fiscal policy context, and understand what the economic crisis is actually, how it is impacting, how the budget system is working, and so on. But on the other hand, we also need to understand that these are budgets are played out in a very political way, that whose interests are reflected most in the budget is a political matter, and it's not necessarily just a technical matter. The fact that the economic stimulus packages in the US and around the world have mobilized so many resources so quickly and benefited certain banks and capital companies, whereas it's so difficult to mobilize money towards poverty, is really a political question. So the very beginnings of the experiences on gender responsive budgeting were in Australia and in South Africa. And since then, we have seen quite an expansion of numbers of countries that have taken up the work on gender responsive budgeting in different ways. In many countries, this was work by governments, within government led by ministries of finance, or by sectoral ministries, or by the national women's machinery. In others, it was the civil society actors. And every time I show this this table, just listing the countries that that I know of that have these experiences, somebody says, you know, but you've left out Zimbabwe or I don't know where. So this is an ongoing work, and this is never a comprehensive listing, but just to give you an idea that this is work that is being picked up by a growing number of countries. The way the experiences have been emerging is we can make a distinction between different types of experiences. One has looked really at the governance side of the work on budgeting, and looked at the public finance management systems that are put in place, and that relates to looking at the regulatory framework for budgeting, what are the laws that govern budgeting, what are the roles within the government, who's responsible for what. Is it the Ministry of Planning? Is it the Ministry of Finance? Is it the President's Office? Is it the Treasury, etc.? What type of budget formats are being used in the country? Some countries use the economic classification of budget lines. Others are moving towards performance-based budgeting. So a lot of the work on gender-responsive budgeting have tried to engage at that level, and really looking at how can we make sure that the systems that are introduced, the legal frameworks, the formats of the budgets allow us to integrate a gender perspective, allow us to be able to monitor where allocations are going towards women. Other experiences have really been concerned with going to the end result and spending less time on those public finance management systems, but rather saying we need to see more money going towards maternal mortality or towards violence against women or whatever priority is seen. And in that aspect, it's really working with the sectoral ministry that is concerned with this specific area of priority, or at the local level. So just to share with you a couple of examples from countries very quickly. When I started, I was saying that the work on gender budgeting required a need, some kind of change of mindset of women's rights activists, but also ministries of finance and some economists. And this has not been very easy, but we have, in UNIFEM, have been able to build very good partnerships in some countries, in Ecuador and in India and Morocco and Venezuela and Nepal. Ministries of finance are really getting very engaged in the work on gender-responsive budgeting, and I always say this, that this is not necessarily because all of a sudden the ministries of finance have become feminist and are very happy with advancing women's rights. Maybe this is the case, but to understand that this has been a process where in some way there were two agendas that merged together. On the one hand, ministries of finance are supposed to make sure that they have results-based budgets, that they are able to have systems in place that show how much they were able to achieve with whatever resources were there. They are supposed to create systems and guidelines and build capacities of sectoral ministries to use these kinds of systems. And in the same time, this is very similar to what we're talking about, that we want to make sure that government budgets are spent in a way that actually addresses inequalities, that shows results for women, that monitors and regularly tracks the benefit and the impact and so on. So in some respects, I think this is what we were able to do. And this partnership with ministries of finance entailed looking at guidelines, building capacities, looking at the producing regularly annual reports with the budget to say what happened with the money that we are asked, which we got last year, or these are the targets that we are setting for the money that we are receiving this year. And Morocco has been one of the countries that has been producing this over the past 4 years. Similarly, in India, they have the gender budget statements that are being produced. And from many experiences, especially in Latin America, I think we have a lot of examples where there has been, the entry point has been at the sectoral level with really pushing for and advocating for more money going towards specific priorities. And we have a number of examples where there has been concrete changes in budget allocations from year to the other towards certain areas of women's priorities. And of course, while budgeting is mainly an internal government process, its success, its transparency, and its strength is really the extent to which actors outside government are able to follow what is happening, monitor it, and generate some kind of checks and balances over what's happening inside the government. And a lot of the experiences that we've been seeing have been really a very strong role of civil society and increasingly more engagement of members of parliament in their budget oversight role. And we think these are critical, especially if they are taking women's rights into consideration. And there's a lot of civil society groups around the world that have been working a lot on poverty and budget transparency, but not necessarily being gender sensitive. And I think this is one area that alliances between women's groups and civil society organizations working on poverty are very important. With the increase in decentralization, and I think really understanding that the work on budgeting just needs to follow the systems that are in place within a country. So when we're talking about spending on social sectors or health and so on, we, in a context of decentralization, the role of local government becomes very important, but also understanding that do local government have access to the to revenue raising authority, or do they have the responsibility to deliver to the citizens at the local level without having the necessary resources being transferred from the central government. And looking at the fiscal decentralization systems that look at the channels of which the central budget is transferred to local level and the capacity of the local level to respond to the needs and whether the budget is adequate. Just to share with you just a few issues that are, of course, make this work a little bit more complex. Of course, the question of data availability and having access to budget information. A lot of the countries that we've been working in are at the very lowest levels of the budget transparency index, and it's almost impossible to have access to the proper budget records, and that's a big challenge. The other question is the capacity of public sectors to do the planning and execute budgets in a gender-sensitive way, and a lot of what we're trying to do is supporting the establishment of systems and capacity and skills, as well as political commitment to engage in this work and not see that if I'm just doing my plan and budget for this year and, you know, I don't have time to be thinking about gender, so let's talk about it later, or this is an additional thing. It needs to be seen as an integral part of the work. And even within the way the public sector actually operates, we have been seeing more and more investment in women's departments and gender units within ministries. And usually those departments are completely isolated from the whole planning and budgeting units. And we are now talking about what does it mean if we're talking about the gender units, gender to be part of the planning and budgeting process, why are we putting the gender units as completely outside? So it has to do with some kind of organizational development and understanding where more strategically the position of expertise on gender needs to be placed at the sector level. And of course, as I said before, there are we understand governments have conflicting agendas and different actors and different groups, interests of people and so on. So this is where the whole political questions need to be kept in mind. My time is up, but just to say from the experiences that we've seen, we know that in some countries we're able to see more progress than in others. And there are some enabling conditions that we have noticed looking at different countries. The question of the extent to which the country has transparency, the extent to which the government has committed to a reform process, whether in its budget reform or in the public sector reform. Also, the need for champions within the country, that it's very important to see there is some kind of leadership from the national actors that exists, that can open channels within the country. I won't be repeating these. Mentioned them before. So I'll stop here. And I think we can open the floor for questions.
Thank you very much for presentation. I have two questions. What is the criteria according to which you choose the countries in which you intend to incorporate gender budget? This is one. And the second, when incorporating gender-sensitive articles within the state budget, what are the main challenges? Both society, government, and technical changes. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. My question and comment followed by a question is going to be a bit provocative. Yeah. And I'm speaking from the experience of Jamaica with very limited exposure to gender budgeting, but some exposure to child-responsive budgeting and our experience with the child-responsive budgeting program, which we got involved in on the back of South Africa's program on child-responsive budgeting. And the challenge that we are having is that if the institutional capacity and those who work in the policy-making environment are not willing or even not at the level where they're convinced that a rights-based approach in policymaking actually makes sense, moving from the analytical and mainstreaming approach to then inserting the budgeting, I find has been problematic. So we have stepped back and we have said, you know what? We will deal with the budgeting later. Let us deal with building people's analytical lens and building people's responsiveness to a rights-based approach in the development programs first. So we actually refused funding for child-responsive budgeting after a while, right? And the approach that we have taken is give us the money for technical support in building capacity for policy analysis, so for the analytical aspect of it. So, and we got a bit of slack because we were saying, how can you refuse donor money? But quite frankly, we took the perspective, if it's not serving a purpose, not because it is donor money, we should take it. So we sent it back. The challenging question that I have to you is, how different is gender budgeting from this approach? Because the challenge that we also have is that it is not something that can be incorporated or inserted. It requires a complete overhaul of how the budgeting process works. And our budgeting process is something that we inherited from the colonial system before, and it has not even gone through gone through enough transformation to suit our own developmental needs. It is still very quite irrelevant for our own needs. So there's that problem that we already have to face, much less to get into insertion, incorporation. So I go back to the question, how practical or relevant is it then to move in that direction without addressing the other needs that some of the countries, such as Jamaica, would have in this particular area. Hank, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I think it's a real concern. Yeah.
I completely see what you're saying, and these are actually some of the questions that we are faced with as we're doing the work. As I mentioned in the end, there are some places where there are enabling conditions that exist that allows us to engage with this work in a meaningful kind of way. Because I can tell you from the list of countries that I was provided, not every experience is based on a meaningful understanding of a transformative approach to budgeting that puts equality at the heart of that. That is ideological, that is political, and in many respects, the people who work on the budget don't care about these things. So it is a process of transformation, and it is important to start with what you are mentioning, understanding the broader the public finance management system, where its roots are, what it technically allows you to do and what it doesn't, and where are the opportunities to make a change. And in many ways also we need to understand this is a long-term process. As long as I think the main starting point is in your analysis of what the needs are, where the gaps are, and what the needed interventions for those. If we're talking about human development and social justice, budgeting and comes as the last spot. If we have the proper analysis of where the inequalities exist, where the problems are, we are able to say what kind of spending we need to be seeing. For example, when we keep on talking about unemployment amongst women, what is known because of years and years of analysis that you need to invest in childcare in order to see more women in the marketplace. It's not about, okay, let's create these microfinance little projects. We know that. And this is based not on budget genius, it's based on a social analysis and economic analysis that is able to identify where the interventions are needed. And if you don't have that, you cannot have gender-responsive budgeting following this. I think the issue of the criteria to choose the country that we work with is definitely looking at where the enabling conditions are, but also just to clarify, the way the United Nations works is you are facilitating efforts that are existing or are being initiated at the ground, either from the government partners or civil society or different actors in a country. So if there are groups, and I think the beginnings of our work on gender-responsive budgeting were in countries where there has already been work going on, in Uganda with Powode, which is a women's organization, an NGO there, in Tanzania, TGNP. So it wasn't like UNIFEM moved into country X and said, okay, let's do gender-responsive budgeting, nobody's going to listen to us. Where there is interest from the women's organizations, from the ministries, from the different actors at the ground, we have been able to engage more and more with them.
Yes, thank you, Nizreen, for the presentation. I really enjoyed it. I think, you know, at some point you talked about competing agendas when you looked at PRSP and others. I think I would see them more as complementary agendas, because actually you cannot just go and intervene in the budget. If the gender equality priorities are embedded in your poverty reduction strategy, it is more likely that the government would use it to mobilize funds to implement it. And I can give the case of Liberia, the recent Liberia PRS, where they were able to have gender around all the pillars of the PRS, including security sector reform or economic revitalization. They even have a pillar on gender-based violence. It means that if it is there, it is likely to follow throughout the cycle of financing and so on. So to me, it's complementary. The second idea is about the sectoral approaches you talked about. I think in some cases it is also important to have a sub-sectoral approach. For example, the education sector in Senegal. For many years, we were having strikes at the university level, students going on strike. And I think the way the government decided to address it is just to give a grant to everybody. You don't go to school, that month you don't get your grant, so everybody is at school. But if you then look at the budget allocations in relation to the enrollment rates between primary, secondary, and tertiary, you would see that women are likely to be enrolled in primary and secondary. And by putting that much proportion of the budget in the tertiary education, you know, you were kind of discriminating in terms of budget allocation. So I think the subsector is also very, very important. The third is the role of parliament, which I would like to emphasize. And I think maybe because they can ask the right questions and they can question government, I see it as a very critical entry point. And it's not just about budgets, but you have also the whole dimension of women's representation in parliament and so on. And for example, in Rwanda, because simply they have as many women as men in the parliament, they could threaten to reject the budget if the government didn't increase the proportion for gender. So it's a whole area of things that contribute to gender budgeting. And I think we should deepen work on parliament as an entry point. Thank you.
I have a question that I will ask later. I just wanted to interrupt the process of question and answer so that we can all take a minute to thank Pinaki Chakraborty for joining us. He's going back to India. He's leaving in 5 minutes from now. And it was really lovely to have him here with us. We miss, of course, his wife, who was not here with us. But next time, Leka and Pinaki Chakraborty will be joining GEMIWG, I'm told. And thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful travel back. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Actually, gender-responsive budgeting, this is really something that I am passionate about, because I am involved in the national development planning process. So, you know, from the planning process, then you translate to in Uganda. But I'd like to agree with what Taito has said about the approach to gender-responsive budgeting. In my country, yes, guidelines on gender-responsive budgeting are part of the Ministry of Finance called SACHILA. You know, so it assumes that whoever gets the guidelines then should read them and then follow them through and be able to identify the various different needs of men and women. Unfortunately, this is not really the case. And my best experience was within my organization. I was inquiring, I was saying, do we have any gender responsive budgeting guidelines? And the guys who are responsible for preparing the budget, they said, no, you know, we never get them. I said, really? How come that when you read the call circular, it's indicated as an attachment? And the guys were really dead sure that they had not received anything. So I said, well, can you bring the guidelines, whatever you have? And when we went through, then we found that the guidelines were attached, and we really laughed. And the guy said, well, we have never seen them, and even in our sector working group, this issue never comes up at all. And it is really indeed true, because right now we are in the process of formulating the National Development Plan, and we did give gender guidelines in terms of integrating gender issues into the National Development Plan. Very elaborate, and they looked really simple guidelines. But when the ministries submitted their first drafts, in the situation analysis, no gender analysis was contained in there. In terms of priorities, you know, nothing, objectives, strategies, and activities, nothing. So I then learned that actually the biggest problem is the gender capacity. The capacity to integrate gender into these various programs that we are interested in. And when we had a meeting for the sector task forces to review progress, and then we said, how come you had not integrated in your situation analysis? There is no gender analysis. And they said, well, we don't know how to do it, you know. They were really frank. They said, we don't know how to do it. But some of those who are saying they don't know how to do it, they actually had gender focal points in their ministries. Then when you talk to the gender focal points, then, you know, they are really at the lower level within the ministry. They are not in the mainstream. And also having just one person talking about gender, I mean, she can be ignored. So for me, my suggestion is that if we really want to promote the whole idea of gender, that we need now to go to the top. We have been operating at the bottom, you know, trying to get our gender focal points in there. I think we need to target the top leadership, because the way you know, and you talked about Fawode, the way the civil society operate is that they begin at the top. You know, if it's a district, they target the district local councils, and from there they then get their entry points. And Winnie, she had a very successful gender responsive budget program, and I read her approach. It was basically targeting the real decision makers and training them and building their capacity. So I think we need to really, if we need to make a change, if we don't go to the top, the lower people, really, it's not going to, we shall not move very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Nizrin, for the presentation. I would like to start by sharing the work that we were doing on this area and to focus more on women's involvement, because if it is important to have an entry point as ministries or the local authorities also, it's important to involve women in the movement. And what we did in AWOMI is we just start the budget initiative, and we know that UNIFEM is very involved in this work in Senegal. And recently, after the local election, we got a lot of women's mayor. And what we did is we tried to set up a kind of coalition which involve the women's mayor, the women's organization, youth organization, that can start discussing the budget since the planification process. and then use this women's leader also as an entry point to get the national levels to address the thing that you were talking about the fact that sometimes there is there is limitation of the local resources. We want to choose this leader as a advocate agents that can bring the topic in the national level. I would like to know, as UNIFEM is involved in a very large number of countries, how do you get women involved in the process if you are working with them in the different country?
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for your very extensive presentation. I have two questions, I guess a comment and a question, which kind of link to Taitu's remark and some of the others. And I guess my first question is, has there been like a a critical review of the gender budgeting experience? And I ask that because there's been a lot of it started in the Caribbean and by the Commonwealth. And they start and then they've got these very big start and then they kind of peter out, or they're there and they're just in names. And I remember having a conversation at the 8th Commonwealth Ministers meeting with Debbie and others, and even talking with South African women, and they're saying, well, you know, this stuff started and we started it, but we are not seeing a heck of a lot of traction on it. So my question is, what has been the sustainability of it? How do you measure, what are the benchmark and the achievements of all these countries? And has there been a proper assessment to look at gaps and where it might be, lessons learned and where you might move forward on it? Because I see that within the microfinance community, there is now a whole big process of really looking at it and what has been the gender equality dimensions of it and where things could be better improved, where things could be left off. So that's one. My other question is around the Paris Declaration and the new aid modalities. I had an occasion to look at some of this, and it's about a year, and I haven't followed it up, so I'm curious. There was a sense in which when you talk to gender equality and gender budget people about the different modalities, and there was some anxieties, to put it in my words, about direct budget support, and that direct budget support might actually be shrinking the space for gender equality intervention and shrinking the space for the voices of women within some of these budget frameworks. Especially, I think, in Kenya, there was some concern about the Joint Assessment Committee and whether that would replace the individual agencies, including the national machineries, who, as we know, are not very powerful in the budget to begin with, but if they got knocked out by these Joint Assessment Committee or HACs or whatever. So my question is, how has UNIFEM found the aid modalities? Have they found that those are really good pathways for integrating and including gender budgeting? Same thing with the OBAs in terms of their tendency to put cost recovery. How do you deal with off-budget things or things that are coming in already not linked to sectoral issues that would provide health care and so forth? Our budget that are coming in that are direct budget support, how do you engender those in a budget stream? Yeah.
I heard two of the questions I had, so I will take only a much shorter time in asking my question. You mentioned the issue of unemployment and childcare, and I cannot agree more with you, Nesrin, on this. It is really frivolous to be talking, you know, on one side of our mouth to say one thing and then not to have the preconditions that would allow women. Sometimes I think that because of the restrictions that are imposed on the budget, because we have to work within the budgetary constraints, it has been a great service to all of us that at least gender issues have entered somewhere, and we have to look at the political time and the political context within all of this work started when there was no space to do anything. So not to take away from that part, The point is very much related to Nesrin. I'm not going to talk about budgets, but the issue of employment, because there is the exact parallel, I think, with the approach that we have taken with gender-responsive budgeting. If I ask only for childcare, and the government even says yes, but at the same time, I cannot have a voice about fiscal and monetary policy that expands the economy, that creates jobs, it doesn't quite make sense to prioritize for the government the childcare, because you are going to be freeing up labor that nobody wants. What is the rationale? How do you prioritize, right? So the rethinking of the budget is important, but only to the degree that there is space to say, you need this and you need that and you need that, and you have the ability to add it on. The redivision and redistributing, essentially, that has taken place a lot of times has not, I think, served us as well, and I just wanted your reflections and the difficulties that you face with these issues, because I know that you have the same desires and the whole community has the same desires. But how do you navigate and negotiate these two constraints?
Just have a small one. I heard you talk about the steps you go through when you are budgeting, if you are to ensure a budget is gender sensitive. But I didn't hear you actually talk about the monitoring of the execution of the budgets. Because budgeting is one thing, and then executing is actually another. And this is the most important. Because the government will tell you, yeah, our budget is gender sensitive. But when it comes to execution, it's a different story altogether. Now, the other thing is what somebody behind there has just talked about. Most of the monies, actually, which I think developing countries use, are either bilateral or multilateral, that kind of thing. And it's normally off budget. I'll give you an example of the money we use for children. It's off budget. And this money is actually kind of targeted and it's gender insensitive, gender blind kind of. Have you made an effort maybe to talk about most of these organizations that provide that kind of money? And then the other one is, I'm always confused. Of course, I run a program for children. And this program, they tell us if you have an activity which deliberately targets, say, the orphans and other vulnerable children, you kind of stigmatize them. We also had another problem in one of our universities because we wanted to increase the intake of girls into the university. We kind of lowered the intake, the mark for the intake for girls. But you know, the girls who are feeling like they are less equal. So isn't it really stigmatizing to have maybe deliberate interventions specifically for the women? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll make my remarks maybe in the context of my country. And I think it's the case in most of African countries. For this budget, gender-responsive budgeting, to make an impact, we really have to understand the budgetary process. And in most of these economies, it's actually a preserve of the means of either means of planning or means of finance. And most of these, let's say the civil society and the NGOs that work with the gender issues, most of the time do not even get integrated in the budgetary process, because we start by setting the macro framework, and then we have what we call the sector working groups. And in my opinion, it is at that level where most of these gender issues or situational analysis of gender situation should come in.
So if you don't have, like, maybe those entry points where you could do an analysis, and you have these sector biddings, because whatever goes into the budget will depend on those sector priorities. And we have these sector biddings, and then you set the sector, the macro frameworks more or less sets the ceilings. And then the sectors, of course, the allocations will be done based on these sectoral biddings. So it's at that particular point, if you don't have a well-structured, and as we've been saying maybe in the past, that you need to bring concrete issues. Otherwise, just saying, oh, women are marginalized, what, that situation analysis must be concrete ideas that can be brought on the table. And we've seen in cases where this has happened. Also, you don't really expect an overall big impact, but this has to be gradual and in small doses. So the entry points and understanding the budgetary process to me is very important. And I'm glad in one of the slides you also mentioned parliament. In our countries, also the parliamentary institutions are very powerful, and these are male dominated. And they are the ones that pass laws. And these laws have gender inequality kind of laws, or it can be gender liberating. So some of the advocacy and institutions that have been working with parliament have actually also been able to make an impact. In my country, there was a very strong, she's not an economist, but she's a very strong gender advocacy for gender, who happened to be a nominated member of parliament. And she strongly passed a bill, argued in the parliament, for tax waiver on sanitary pads, because most girls in schools they don't go to school during their menstrual periods because of the, it's shaming, because they have to stay at home until they're through with their periods before they go to school. So it was actually affecting school performance of most of girls in the rural areas. And she strongly argued that the government needs to remove all the taxes on sanitary pads, so that at least most of these girls can access them. And she succeeded in doing that, and at the moment, the sanitary pads are not taxed, although the cost didn't come down, and maybe the impact was not so much, but at least it was an effort.
Thank you for all the questions. I don't know if I'm in a place to answer a lot of them. But really, a lot of the questions that you have raised are about the challenges in real life in each of the countries regarding the capacities, the politics, the roles of different actors, the gender issues, the pressures on the government and on the budget. And I think the key message that I have learned is, although, yes, we say different countries, different realities, and so on, but the fact of the matter is, in almost every country, we have a crisis of governance, a crisis of resources, and a crisis of injustice and inequalities. And the issue with the work on gender-responsive budgeting is that we're saying, trying to address these crises requires, in addition to our work and advocacy on so many levels, looking seriously at the money side and at the economic policies and fiscal policies. And something like the food crisis and the energy crisis and now the financial crisis that was exported to become an economic crisis, these are realities that show how these challenges affect all the achievements that are made in addressing inequalities in so many respects. All it takes is just this one bump, and we're setting ourselves back another 10 years. If we believe these are important issues to address, and that if we have the system set up right and the money managed right, then we are able to achieve results. And I think we all agree on this, and the importance of looking at budgets as part of our strategies to be demanding. And I think this is where maybe I did not really highlight this enough, the importance of economic data and evidence that is generated by economic researchers and people like yourself to say, you know, based on data, this is what is the contribution, this is what is the unemployment, this is what is the cost, and this is what is, we are able to make a much stronger case to say, you know, there's a different side of the story, and we are a little bit more strategic about how we make this case. And I think even, you know, the question about the how do we engage women's groups, and I think definitely the role of women's civil society, women's organization, community-based organizations, and national women's machinery, women parliamentarians inside the parliament is very important. But they're not the only key actors in this. I think it's important for women's groups to create alliances with economists, with ministries of finance, with a lot of the comments were about how do we understand where the power structures are, where the decision-making structures exist, and which ones do we need to target. So, and I think this is where women's organizations also need to develop different kind of skills and use their energies more efficiently, in a sense. And a lot of the work that we've been doing has really been in looking at a certain leadership from the women's organizations, especially with regard to gender analysis, to saying what are the priorities, where are the gaps, and how do they need to be addressed, and then link it up with where the policy channels exist. I'm not going to talk about the Paris Declaration and aid questions, because we're going to cover that in the session in the afternoon. But on your question on evaluation, I think this is an ongoing learning process. And actually, in UNIFEM, we are currently carrying out our second expanded evaluation of the work on gender budgeting. And hopefully, this will be available within the coming few months. But we have to also know that we've been learning. There's been a lot of learning on the work on gender budgeting. And if I look just as into 2000, when this whole work was just being started, and where we are today, I think we've really progressed, at least in our understanding of what is the challenge and where the success of gender responsive budgeting needs to be. But we also have to acknowledge where the limitations are, that if gender responsive budgeting work needs to be successful, every government and every donor who is supporting budget sector reform needs to be convinced that gender budgeting needs to be part of the budget reform. This is not the case. We would be in the same country working with the Ministry of Finance on gender responsive budgeting. The World Bank comes, or GTZ comes, and comes with a much bigger, much more lucrative project for a budget reform that destroys everything that we've tried to do over 5-6 years of building capacity and understanding and tools in the Ministry of Finance And all of a sudden, this is all totally marginalized, and there is a whole new package that is being presented. But these are all the challenges and realities that that exist, and we still think, despite these challenges, we still need to engage with them. On the final, my final note relates to the question that Rania has raised. This has always been a question for me in my head. Is the work on gender-responsive budgeting about the quality of resources spent, or is it about the quantity? And definitely, do we need more money for gender equality? I think we all agree on that. And do we need to see the money targeted towards women spent in a way that places women's rights and women's empowerment at the core of it? Also, yes. It's not either or. What we know is that there is very little money that is going towards women's priorities, whether we're talking about domestic resources or money coming from ODA. But we also know that whatever money exists is spent in a pathetic kind of way, and it deals with women as a vulnerable group. And we're still talking about microfinance and sewing machines, and we're talking about support to increasing women's access to antiretrovirals only during their pregnancy, and the minute the woman has the baby, it doesn't matter if she's HIV positive or not. This is where the money is going, and this is where the money is going and being reported on as going towards women. But it's actually going towards women who are pregnant so that they have healthy babies, and we really don't care about the woman after she has the healthy baby. This leads me to the question of monitoring and evaluation. I definitely think this is something very important, and if I missed saying that, I apologize. But definitely it's a key element of the work, because to close the loop of whether we're talking about the planning or the budgeting, we really need to end it with the last step of monitoring what we've done with the money. And the key tool that is used to do that is indicators. So starting with the PRSPs, when governments formulate the PRSPs, they a set of performance assessment indicators are identified, and this is a list of indicators that basically say in a year's time we need to see how far we've gone to achieve those the objectives, and to how do we spend the money that we put within this framework. 99% of the cases, these indicators do not look at dimensions of gender equality. If you will find indicators, you will find an indicator that tells you a number of pregnant women who have access to ARVs. It will not tell you the increase in number of women who have entered into the labor market. It will not tell you how many women have graduated and so on. So this becomes part of the challenge of actually even refining our monitoring systems to make sure that we are closing the loop, we are making sure that the plans are gender sensitive, we are making sure that the execution is benefiting the right groups, and we are making sure that the way we monitor and assess our work continues to put the same important elements we started with throughout the whole process. What happens is, somebody talked about the PRSP, nothing being there in the analysis. You mentioned that the analysis was gender blind. What is happening now is you have far more gender analysis in the background of any policy document, but then as you're moving towards the implementation and more towards allocation of budget and in the evaluation, this evaporates. So you start and you're like, oh, and the women and women's rights, and they are key agents of development, and da da da. And then you look at the budget, there's nothing going, and when we assess whether we've done a good job, we basically look, have we created fiscal balance? Have we cut down our inflation and budget deficit? Check, that's a success. So even how we define what is successful government is needs some work. Thank you. Thanks to all of you.